Friends of the Gathering Podcast. So for this, the third episode of season two of the Gathering Podcast, we sat down with Leslie Oquendo, who is an author. He wrote a very interesting book, and this has unlocked, it seems like, an appetite to keep writing for him. But he also works in business development and has a history in, talent, I guess.
Yeah. Started out in talent, went to business development, but that's not what the podcast touched on. Admittedly, this was not a fly-by-night. We planned to do the podcast, and we ended up talking about philosophy outside of the podcast arena.
Right.
And then we just jumped into it and said, hey, we've got 30 minutes. Let's make the most of it. And I think because of that time crunch,
yeah,
it forced us into like a really interesting conversation. And in the conversation we had outside where he was meeting you for the first time and he literally did his homework on you as an individual. And that's why that question came up. He's like, oh,
right.
I scrolled all the way down your LinkedIn profile and saw that you studied comparative religion.
See, like in the last, we were talking about Sean Drazy and social engineering. There you go. Recruiters need to do that. They need to do the diligence on who they're going to talk to know them well.
Yeah. And Leslie shares some of his tips on how to do that homework, as well as tackling the really tough subject of grief through writing a book, which is incredible and wish more people did and talked about.
Absolutely. So lots to look forward to in this episode.
Listen to the people. Listen to the people. People. People in culture. Oh, yeah. It's time for the Gathering Podcast. The Gathering Podcast. It's time for the Gathering Podcast.
Okay, we're back.
We're back.
Here we go.
At the Gathering Podcast, I'm Martin Hawk.
And I'm Kasim Virji. Welcome, man. Thanks for joining us at Startwell.
Thanks, man. I'm really humbled to be here with you guys.
We're jumping in.
Do it. Interrogation starts now.
It's where's the microchip?
Right? I don't know.
There you go. Yeah. Why didn't microchip come to mind?
Yeah. Because when I stepped into this room, it was just very intense. Like it was an interrogation room.
Oh, because it's all black.
You got this big mass of light. And then my mind always goes towards like, where's the microchip? Like slamming the table. Like, where is it?
You stole it. If I was being interrogated in a room like this, like if the police arrested me and brought me to this sort of place, I would talk for 10 days straight about everything. I'd be like, I'm so comfortable. This is great. You have cappuccinos. Awesome.
Right. I wouldn't be mad at it. Very well branded, you know, aesthetic is great.
When's the last time, you know, that experience has been designed, right? Because the good cop, bad cop routine exists. But have they iterated since the 1960s, 1950s,
whatever? I don't know. Luckily, you know, knock on wood, I have not been arrested or interrogated formally since I was 15 and on a trip with friends in Uganda. We got arrested.
Yikes.
We got interrogated, but we corroborated our stories about our fake identities and they let us go. And
because you had a microchip.
We were turning our car around in front of what turned out to be the head of the CID's like house, but we didn't know that. We were just, you know, down the wrong road and we were changing direction and moving our cars and trying to get, you know, to this restaurant for dinner. And suddenly, while we were turning the car around, we were surrounded by army guys with AK-47s. And when we rolled down the windows, we heard ch-ch, and we were like, uh-oh.
Whoa.
So they said, go inside. We went inside. We were like, okay, guys, we're all students from Canada, right? So that's our story. We're just here. We're turning our car around. And we're like, this is no story. We're just not lying. But we all had fake IDs because we didn't want them to have our real phone numbers anyway. We were like, young in Africa, you need a fake ID. You can't lose your real ID if they take it to bribe you or something. So we knew what was going on. And we had President Museveni's phone number. So in case it got real bad, we would call the president and get, you know, out of there. But look, this podcast is not about me.
Now I've got to talk about myself.
Yeah.
After you just mentioned, oh, I have the president's number and the microchip.
That's a trailer. This is a short trailer.
Oh my God.
But flipping the script.
Sure.
I think context is important. We're late for this podcast. We were supposed to start half an hour ago,
But we were talking about life, the universe, and everything else in terms of like spirituality. Kasim, you've got an interesting background. Leslie, you clock that because you're a recruiter and you do great research. And, I think the most interesting thing about Leslie, and we're not like crazy friends, we're like soon to be better friends, I think, right? Okay. Randomly met on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Reached out. We had coffee. And I was like, Leslie's one of the coolest people I know. And from that, we're like, we should do a podcast. And that's why we're here.
Amazing.
But we only have so much time. So we're going to do like speed rounds.
Speed rounds. Let's do it. Rapid fire.
First question.
Hit me.
Owl tattoo.
Yeah. Ooh, okay. Owl tattoo. Yes. So I got this mid-20s and it was to represent wisdom. You know, I think that there are moments in our lives where we get older, you know, we get the gut punches, but we don't take a time to reflect and actually understand what the lesson was. So there were a lot of lessons up until that point that I was like, you know what, let's just like put it on our forearm. I mix it in with some sunflowers, just kind of, you know, always remind myself about positivity and lightness. I think RuPaul has a quote where he mentions that, you know, you can be negative, but positivity will always get you success no matter what.
Mm.
So it was just kind of this one driver for me where it was like, okay, just like have a good attitude,
yep,
keep things moving, and things will line up when they need to.
I love it. I love that that's tattooed on your arm to remind you of this. That's powerful.
Thank you.
I took a more negative route when I just went, you've only got one life left.
Lives remaining zero
so
on your
arm. I think
that's
negative because I remember when you posted that on LinkedIn, I found that to be really insightful because the whole premise of it was like, go out because you got one life, go out, go do your thing, and like, don't hold back on it. And I remember like when Martin and I were having that breakfast in the East End, it was the idea that if you're not, can I say like, can I say the F word? Can I swear here?
Castle. We don't discriminate.
Okay, perfect.
So you won't get reported to HR.
Okay, but well, you have the president's number, so I'm good, right? If anything would happen.
Yeah.
I think he's still the president. I don't have his number anymore, but go for it.
It was a pizza number. If you're not shitting your pants, you're not living big enough. We chat about this. Remember when I said that to you?
Yeah, yeah.
And like, it's so true. Like, we're in a room here of people who have like, who are living really big lives, and it's scary and risky and messy and all of it. Mm. But like, I'm sure when we all have a moment to reflect on it, you know, we wouldn't have it any other way.
Yeah, man. It's true. Eat papaya, wear white pants, go forth into life.
Why not eat papaya? I missed the memo.
Papaya helps you, you know.
Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
What is this?
Diarrhea?
Okay.
Oh.
Well, maybe not. Don't eat too much papaya. But if you're constipated, eat some papaya.
This is not universal.
I was like, can grossly. I please learn with this? This is dropping the mic to me. So.
Yeah, sorry. More fling.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway. Right.
All right.
But yeah, go forth and conquer. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Next question. You speed round it.
Cool. Okay. So obviously this is a podcast. I don't know how obvious this is, but Martin hopefully invited you with context. So Gathering is a podcast aimed at kind of like unveiling some personal stories, but also perspective from people that are, you know, engaged in their work life, in people and culture, HR, these sorts of roles, bringing people together and trying to like motivate them and help make them enjoy or enable them to enjoy their work lives. So in a quick spin, give us your story work-wise.
My story work-wise. Okay. So I went to work right after high school.
Wow.
I did not go to university or college. Coming from an Asian family and an only child.
That must have been tough.
It was really tough. Yeah. And my mom had her first stroke. And when that happens, because we lost a source of income, I went straight to work.
Mm.
So I worked through hospitality and different organizations. I worked at Loblaws, you name it. And I found my way at a hospitality startup company where basically I was a shift supervisor.
Okay.
And then the owner saw me with customers and was like, hey, like you're really engaging. I'd love to see if you want to hire for the company. And that's where I kind of like got my recruitment start and then built that forward, and that leveraged me to, you know, different tech organizations. And that's kind of where I am today.
See, this is so interesting because like we hear this often on this podcast that a lot of people's path into a formal role at an organization in HR, anything to do with people, is that they're people. right? Ergo, the name of your
people group.
Spot on.
It's about people. It's about being good with people, enjoying their stories, and being able to support their stories continue, right? Tech. So what are some examples of companies that are like tech companies that you have worked at, or where are you working now?
Yeah, so Foodora Canada.
Okay.
Was my first like foray into tech.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
How did that feel to be, you know, managing people or working with people when you started?
That's a great question. Humbled.
Did you have to like learn a lot in terms of?
Absolutely. Yeah. It is a tightly run ship. Like, it's amazing to understand the processes and how they operate the recruitment cycle. So I think that for me, it was balancing, okay, you know, the corporate side, but then also maintaining what makes you you.
Right.
Right. And what makes you a really great recruiter. And I remember from like different experiences in my past life talking with Martin, you know, it was the idea of going through that LinkedIn, right? Going through their profile, seeing them as a human being, and understand ways that you can have those small little moments that are so much stickier, right? Mm-hmm. When you're talking about your background for schooling, talking about religion, talking about that you can speak Swahili and you've come from Nairobi. Like, it's things like that where it's like, whoa.
For the record, my Swahili is terrible. Minajua kidogo, kidogo.
I was gonna greet you with jumbo, but I wasn't sure if that was like
jumbo.
Cool.
It's cool. It's not like super hip, but it's cool. It's real.
Yeah.
It's like saying hello.
Right.
Yeah, but do people say hello? So.
So like, I said jumbo would have been like, all right, grandpa.
Well, like, a cooler way, and I sound like an old man to some of the audience, perhaps, but like would be like. You could say like mambo has become cooler, or you could say like sema. It's like, what's up? Like, say something. That's what it literally means.
Oh,
sema, wow. Is like speak.
Oh shit.
That sounds like Scarborough Russian. Yeah,
pretty fresh,
I love it.
Right?
Sema.
Yeah. Sema. That's
okay.
It.
All right. But yeah, so when you have moments where you can find that stickiness, mm-hmm. like that is where I really came into my own as a recruiter in that people space. Because again, like, people need to remember that in recruitment, it's a terrifying process. Like, you're taking someone, especially if they're like from another country, like I was doing a lot of work with the States, right? Mm-hmm. So you're now reaching out to someone. I'm from Toronto, and you're getting this message on LinkedIn from someone mm-hmm. in Toronto. You're in Alabama. How do you bridge that gap? How do you trust that person from A to close? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And feel respected, feel like you actually want to work here. Because when you go over it, like, it really is such a wild story with recruitment.
Yep.
You know, you're telling them, hey, like, I recognize that, you know, you're working here, but like, what do you actually want to do? What energizes you? And they say this. I might have a role for you that could work out,
mm-hmm.
right? If you're interested, let's get conversations going. And the entire time you're managing that relationship.
It's a very loaded experience, I imagine. What do you find is the receptiveness people have to the opportunities that you present if they are cold like that? Like, are people generally like, man, this is some bullshit. This guy's trying to steal my money. Or are they like, fantastic, this sounds so exciting. Really? Me? You can give me an opportunity?
Everything in between. And I think that it was important for me to have detachment in that. Mm. Right? It was understanding, okay, I have this opportunity for you. If you're interested, amazing. If you're not, that's okay too. Right? You can always come back, keep things open. It was then when you started to come into a place of pushiness where you're like, oh, like, trust me. Like, this is amazing for you. Trust me. It's like,
just get on the pickup truck.
It's right.
Gonna be at the corner at 9 a.m.
You know what I'm saying? I have the president's number. We're good. Like, it's when you start coming from that perspective is when it becomes like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, you don't know my life. You don't know what I want. You don't know my career. You don't know the family I'm supporting. So a lot of it is just coming from a place of what's important to you, what energizes you, and how can I connect you with something that can possibly be interesting.
So this is one of your superpowers, and that's what I noticed when we first chatted in person, was just the ability to disarm the barrier between people so quickly.
Mm.
That was the superpower that you have.
had.
My bad. And it's all washed up.
With this podcast, it's all
written a book.
Jump the
You're
shark.
Done with recruiting.
Right.
I'm trying to salvage it. It's not working. But in terms of like, you could teach a master class in recruiting and I would attend. Oh. And you might be humble about it, but for anyone that wants to start seeing the world from your lens and operating at the level that you do from a recruitment perspective or a sales perspective, and there's an interesting story there that we won't go down today, maybe later.
Ask your question, man.
Let him take his
time. How do you...
No, because I want to get there.
I'm the little kid. All right, cool. So... what are the things that like anyone can start doing that you do to get as good as you? And maybe you don't want to share your secret sauce here, but what is it?
Good question. I think you need to take a moment and go through all the times that you have been a candidate and understand what went wrong there and how you felt. Right. So when you've been ghosted before by a recruiter, right, taking that time to understand, ooh, like that really hurt. How can I now as a recruiter make sure that doesn't happen?
Mm-hmm.
Right. How do I work with my hiring manager and manufacture this entire relationship to ensure that it reflects what we want it to reflect? Like there were moments where I would talk to my hiring manager and then I would have a chat with the candidate. I'd learn all these great things that build a rapport. Mm-hmm. And I put that as notes for my hiring manager, say, hey, they're interested in this, this, this.
Or, that's next level.
And they like this, this, this. And then they can now start off. I'm like, okay, like, do you want to use this to warm up the conversation when you talk to the candidate? And now you're already keeping this like energy from the beginning and carrying it all the way down. And then lastly, whenever did my, and this was recent as well too, that definitely came from learning more. But when I did rejections, it would be on video call.
Yeah.
Not a phone call. And it would be like, I respect you so much. I've been there before. I'm getting you on a video call because I want to see your face. I want you to see my face. I'm not hiding behind anything. Unfortunately, you're not moving forward. And here's why.
At what level? Now, this is me digging into the weeds here.
Dig.
Like, phone screen after, like, the first interview with a company, you're jumping on a video call for the 40 people or 30 people that you've spoken to for a role?
Great question. So... in my career, it's been the mix. It's been the phone call and the video call.
Mm-hmm.
I will always try for the video call because a lot of like
body language.
Body language is such a huge thing. And especially if you're going to be client facing, you're going to be on camera anyways. Yep. And also part of my superpower is seen. You're not going to see my smile, the way I hold myself, all these things that go on behind it. So... that also goes down to finding the right talent to make sure that you are sourcing that this person is like on paper or by resume can do the job. And then you get onto the call and then you have the conversation to now say, okay, now will they be moved forward? Right. Yeah.
The biggest thing I think in recruiting that people don't realize until they get into it is 99% of the people you talk to, you're not giving good news to ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. You only have a certain amount of roles to fill, and that there may be great people that you're talking to as well that you want to hire and you can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's a big thing, too, because, like, I reflected on this, and I think that the best recruiters are not the ones on... sure, like they can take you down the line, right? But the best recruiters are the ones who know how to tell a candidate they didn't get the job.
Yeah.
And who can do it in the most human way possible to so that when they, you know, when they have that rejection, they can say, okay, you know what, I was let down by X company, but this recruiter was fantastic, and like down the line I would like to come back, I would like to reach back out to that recruiter and say, hey, I've taken your feedback, let's talk.
I've got a hard pivot here.
Ooh.
And there's a segue.
Okay,
can I spoil some stuff?
Sure.
So you've written a book about grief.
I have.
And part of me in my brain is like, you naturally, how, like, there is a grieving process to not getting the job.
Good. Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
When you're putting myself in a candidate's shoes, when I've gotten a job I was really stoked for, it's not massive grief, but it's still an emotion that you go through.
Yeah, because anytime that hope is diminished, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough. You have to deal with that personally, everyone.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah. So you've written a book
mm-hmm.
on this, and you know, by nature of podcasts, we've got to talk about it.
I appreciate it. So
yeah, what's your book, author man?
I'll break it down in two spots. So I think that on the recruitment side, it's the attachment. Like that's where it hits you in the gut, is that like you got all this way through it and you pictured yourself
yeah.
at this organization. You pictured yourself in this role. And then it's also like the chatting to other people in the organization about it, right?
Yeah.
It's chatting yeah. to your partner, your spouse, whoever about it as well too. It's the attachment.
Yeah.
And when that gets severed, that's where it hurts the most, right? And the grieving now comes from the understanding that yes, that this is what comes with it. Right. As recruiters, we know that like it might not work out. They could be seen as fantastic at the beginning and then they get all the way down after a demo or after like whatever interview and it doesn't work out. You also have to have attachment because you get attached too. Mm-hmm. You're like, ah, yeah. I really wanted them to work out.
Because yeah. you have to envision that to be able to like you have to understand the role, but you also have to see through it as a lived experience and understand,
right.
oh, wow, this person would be. And you could picture it. I'm sure there's nights where you know, go home from, you know, kind of work and you're thinking about those people. You carry their stories into your life as well.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So,
oh my gosh, I've had some really great stories where I let down a candidate and then they actually were calling me on like a Zoom call and I picked up. They're like, I can't believe you picked up. I'm like, yeah, like what's up? And they're like, oh, I accepted another offer somewhere else. And they're asking this question. Can I get your insight? And I'm like, sure, yeah, like here it is. And here's how I would, you know, kind of take that direction. And they were like, wow, like, thank you so much. Like, mm-hmm. I didn't even take the job with your company and you're still giving me support. And he's like, you know what? Like, I've been telling my wife about you. Like, how about I've had these great experiences on the recruitment side and how it's not like any other experience I've had before. And that's super special. And I'll segue that now into my book.
There we go.
My book is called Is Always Enough Love. And the segue part of it was that as I wrote this book about grief, it really created more space for people to start opening up to me about their own grief stories. Because I found with my own experience that it was either you're on two sides of the spectrum. You either don't talk about it, like the less you talk about it, the more it didn't happen, or I'm open and I can talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. People either kind of, yeah, they dig into it to deal or they hide.
Leave that there. Just right there for you guys.
So, yeah. Leslie, tell us about the impetus for writing this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2021, my mom passed away. And again, sharing at the beginning of this podcast, like as an only child, like it was probably the biggest moment to ever happen the entirety of my life. I still think so even till I die, this will be a huge moment, probably yeah. the biggest moment. And I realized that as an adult, I understand somewhat about death and that it's, you know, that it's inevitable and it's a rite of passage. But as that only child, that 8-year-old kid, that 7-year-old kid, the kid that my mom would take to Chinese grocery stores, to the pool, to the library, that kid was hurting the most. So
I feel like I'm going to cry. It's very emotional. Mm. I'm flipping through this book and I'm picturing my daughter, right? And
mm-hmm.
the bond, of course, that you have with yeah. your child is so strong and they're your best friend. And so, mm-hmm. sorry.
No. I appreciate that. Thanks so much for resonating with yeah. it. And that really, like, I'm glad you tapped on that because it was, how do I talk to that 8-year-old kid and help him understand the passing of his mom?
Yeah.
But also, how does the parent get support now too?
Mm-hmm.
Because as I started to kind of go through my own grief, it was also really understanding my dad as well too.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it went from being super greedy and I lost my mom to be like, yo, he lost his wife. You know what I'm saying? And when you now tap into that, it's like, how do you get the child and the adult on the same, you know, pun intended, page.
Yeah. Mm.
And together, and in their grief together, and going through it. And it's meant to be a companion. So when the initial grief happens, and then next year, 5 years, 10 years, because grief doesn't go away.
Right. And flipping through it also, it's written as, is it? It's written for any age of audience.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, you say kids book, but it really is. The intention was, you know, to kind of have it like, oh, the places you'll go, right? Or The Giving Tree, Sheldon mm-hmm. Silverstein and Dr. Right. Seuss. And it was just this book to really be able to, again, be that companion and create a space where grief is messy.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything. It is anger. It's depression. It is like denial, but it's also humbling and full of gratitude at the same sure. time.
Sure. An opportunity for rebirth and reinforcing your strengths as well as your ability, I think, to own, right? Own the situation, own the relationship that you might have had and always considered as like inherited. It's interesting. So, okay, wait. So tell us about, you know, what there's the experience that led to writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
But then what was the moment where you're like, a book is the thing I need to do to...
Yeah. Great question. So I am a huge journaler. Not sure about you guys, but like I journal like probably like 4 to 5 times a day. Like
wow.
I'm constantly writing and journaling. It's been like a big ritual for me in the morning and at night. And writing has been this thing for me. And then when I went back home to kind of clean up my parents' place, I found all these small little journals that like I was writing as a kid.
Since you were young?
Since I was young. But growing up, it was always tough because I was made fun of for being a writer. And, you know, I was told I was gay in the schoolyard before I even knew I was gay. So I put...
Yeah, it's like retribution. It's like, yeah, I am gay.
Yeah,
it's cool.
Right. And it was like, whoa, like I suppressed it so much because I was scared of like being teased that I just left it.
Right.
So then when I went back, found those journals, I was like, you know what? I love writing. And when my mom passed, it opened up this space of do the things that you want to do and that you love because like, one moment I had my mom, the next day I didn't. So it's like, life is just that temporary.
Yeah.
So go out and do the things.
Yeah.
And that's where I came from. I was like, okay, I love to write. I need to process this and sit with it. And now, where am I hurting the most? It's that inner child. And the whole premise of it was, if I were to sit next to myself as an 8-year-old kid, how would that conversation work out?
Oh, okay.
Right?
I think it's cool. I really think it's not just only about catharsis to be able to kind of rationalize these things, to create something out of them and then share that story and do it in a way that you have the medium to is itself, I think, a healing thing, right? Have you been finding a lot of good vibes by getting these books into people's hands and seeing people read this story?
So it's really interesting because when it was done, I was like, okay, get it into people's hands. It's going to help people. And it's been very humbling to have parents say, you know, I read this book to my kid at night. And to know that my mom is a part of those very intimate conversations with a parent and a kid, and that she's now, her love and her wisdom is in that, is super humbling. But I won't lie to you, it opened up a lot of fear and sadness in me because this story that was so intimate of my mom and I and her passing now became its own entity.
Yeah.
And now it's public, right? And it went from this idea that I was like, okay, oh, now it's out, now it's for everybody, right? And I was like, oh, it's gonna take away from like my relationship with her, like, and it, I was then experiencing, I was trying to my therapist about this, I was re-grieving. Like there were moments where like I couldn't get out of bed or I was achy because as I'm sharing with you guys here,
right,
my mom's story is also now a sales pitch in a sense.
Yeah.
And when people ask me, I have to constantly relive it and explain it and be like really tight with it in a sense as well too. Yeah. So that opened up a whole new space where I was like, whoa. Like, I thought I had this figured out. I really did. I was like, I wrote a book on it. Like, I know grief.
Done.
We're good. Peace out. You know? But that is even more now why it's so special, is that it's constantly evolving.
Sure.
And changes as you get older. And the second you think you have a hand on it, it gets nuanced and different. And it really is that way of how do you live in all of it.
It's an unintended consequence of these, the decisions beforehand of creating it. What I'm wondering right now, again, not again, but like, thank you for A, writing this, and B, sharing it.
Absolutely.
Especially with the fact that, like, I didn't realize until now, I'm like, oh yeah, reliving it, like, constantly because of this thing that you can't necessarily pull back out of the ether. But another part of me, and I don't often do this, but it was like, there's also like a beauty in the fact that, you know, I haven't, I'm going to go on a small tangent, I haven't really lost anyone I was really close to. So when people tell me they've gone through something, I don't know what to do, because the thing I lean on is being able to be empathetic. And then I feel like sympathy is like,
I was like that too when I was a virgin, you know?
That makes sense. But what I'm saying is, like, if you look at it from the perspective of being able to, now you have all these extra moments to think about your mom. Mm-hmm. Whereas my fear would be to, like, you know, for me, out of sight, out of mind is like super real for a million different reasons. And like, it affects my relationships, it affects my friendships, and they think there's this.
So it's tough to live with it, but at the same time, it affords you a means of keeping a memory alive as well. Yeah. Right? The double-edged sword of this.
Yeah.
Is that you're celebrating her life through, you know, this story. And at the same time, kind of forcing yourself perhaps to keep living with it as part of your life, right? Yeah, yeah, understandable. I don't want to diminish your story by bringing it back to your career.
Do it.
But the point you made about relating the personal experience of grief and this amazing story of trying to take something from grief and create something that's, you know, shareable, but also enables people to learn and think through grief. Bringing it back to this kind of idea of attachment people have to their career and how their careers define them. From all of this experience and now your own personal development in understanding grief better, how do you see, yes, we talked about an example of people are looking for a job and they start, you know, they don't get it. But at the same time, what are your thoughts on kind of like career attachment and people in general, whether they're in a job or wanting a job, defining themselves by their job?
Ooh, that's a big question. I think it's very fair. And I think that, again, this is all societal for us, right? Everywhere we go and we see, even like, if you go on LinkedIn, the entirety of it is your worth, you know what I mean? And based upon your career, right?
Yeah.
It's very hard to escape. I think that a lot of it, at least for me, and here's the thing, is that like, there's a really great like Super Soul with Oprah Winfrey and Maya Angelou. And she talks with her at the beginning when she's like, I don't know, like maybe like mid 20 or late or like early 30s. And she asks Maya Angelou like, where would you describe yourself in terms of your spiritual journey? And Maya Angelou responds with, I'm en route. Right? So then now you kind of like, she follows up with her when she's like, I think like in her 70s or 80s. And Oprah asks the exact same question. Where are you on your spiritual journey? And she says, I'm en route.
I love it.
Yeah. Like, I'm still figuring it out. Mm-hmm. And I think that like, that is where I have been trying to stay in that space. Is like, I'm still figuring it out. Like, if I want to be attached to it and have that define my worth in that moment, sure, right? Like, and if will it evolve? Will it change where I can slowly move myself away from it? Absolutely, right? So I think that's my take on it, is that it's very tough. And then you go into the cultural aspect as well too, right? Like, coming from an Asian family, like working hard is very much so a push on your identity, right? So if you don't work, then you're not contributing to the family, or you know you're not caring as much
and you're letting your ancestors down.
Right, and that's a really big weight to have in our culture. Well, for sure.
Preach on, Maymay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it really just is like, if I can just give wisdom, is just like try to make it work as best as you can, and really just stay present with right now. And remember that you're en route, that you're still figuring it out. I don't think you'll ever not have it, you know, I don't think you'll ever get to a point where you're like, done, okay, I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I agree. I think that's extreme wisdom.
Perfect. Yeah.
And it was so nice of you to take time to share your story with us, and at the same time offer some really good nuggets, I think, for our audience, from the recruiter perspective, but also from someone who cares about people finding purpose, as our off-camera pre-interview half an hour philosophical discussion
proves.
Yeah.
Yes, it's been a truly pleasure, Leslie.
Oh my gosh, I'm so humble. Thank you all so much for this space. And yeah, I'm humbled to even be invited and to be holding space with you guys and to share my book. I'm so lucky. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.